Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Michael Quentin Morton about his new book, Masters of the Pearl, A History of Qatar. Michael Quentin Morton, welcome to the show.
Thank you, James. Thank you for inviting me.
Quentin, I wonder if you could begin this interview by telling us a little bit about your intellectual history, how you got to writing this book and why you wrote it.
Well, I guess it all started through the influence of my father, who was an exploration geologist in the Middle East from 1945 to 71, and then became a consultant for various oil companies. And it was through his stories that I first took an interest in the region. And after he passed away in 2003, I wrote his biography, In the Heart of the Desert, which detailed his travels around the region. After that, for the next probably 10 years, I wrote books and articles about the history of oil in the region. But come about 2015, I felt I'd exhausted the history of oil and I wanted to branch out. So I started looking at the history of the Gulf in particular, and wrote a book entitled Keepers of the Golden Shore, which was a history of the United Arab Emirates. Having completed that book, I looked around, and of course, Qatar was in the news at the time with the blockade and everything else. And I'd lived there in the early 50s or to late 50s, and I remembered what it was like before it had been developed. And that to me seemed to be fertile ground for my next book, which I started writing probably 3 years ago.
And you went back in early 2018, if I'm not incorrect, for the first time since you had left Qatar as a child. That must have been, in terms of your memories, quite a culture shock.
It was. I had already been back to the UAE and Oman before then, but of course Qatar I hadn't, and visiting Qatar and touring the district, the area, found a land of great contrast, certainly to the days I remember it from. And really, there's no comparison between Qatar in those days, in the early days of the 50s, and Qatar today. It's been remarkable what's happened. But of course, trying to link the two, the past and the present, is what also attracted me to writing a history of the country, and to try and trace through themes of the past into themes of the present.
If you look at or go beyond what the obvious differences are, the skyscrapers, the modern city, the heavy traffic, a very different demography from the times of your memory. But if you look beyond that, what in your mind has most fundamentally changed in Qatar?
Well, yes, so there's obviously the material side of things, the affluence, and of course the huge influx of foreign workers, which is necessary to maintain the pace of change, the building construction and the like. So those are big changes. And, you know, the Qataris themselves have become what you might say a small minority in their own country. And that obviously is a big change from the past when they dominated. Of course, looking back, part of the population was made up of slaves. And of course, Qatar made that transformation and slavery was abolished. But, you know, the big change is, I suppose, from a traditional society to a modern society. Tribal ways and tribal links still exist, of course, but of course were more prominent and noticeable perhaps in the old days than they are today.
In your book, you quote a popular saying that Qatar is the land God forgot. Would you still say that, given that today Qatar seems a land that is everything but forgotten?
Yes, I don't think you could say that today. Bearing in mind they've been extremely fortunate with their oil discoveries and also with the North Field natural gas. And so it's an extremely rich and very small country. So no, you couldn't say that, I don't think, today. But certainly in the old days, it was a fairly desolate place, undeveloped. And, you know, Doha, of course, was a thriving town, as was Bidda next door to it. And also the pearl fisheries, but the interior was remote and uninhabited except for, you know, passing Bedouins and the like. So it was really the coastal towns that had the wealth from the pearls, but inland it was a fairly desolate place.
Indeed, you describe in great detail the importance of pearls in the formation of Qatar and the quest for wealth as an instrument to wield power, which was true in the day of the pearls, but also seems to be true today in a world of oil and gas.
Yes, certainly pearls gave wealth and wealth gave power. Pearls almost molded Qatari society around it. The English traveller Palgrave visited in 1863. And, of course, there's the famous comment of the ruler at the time, Muhammad al-Thani, who said that we are all slaves to one master, the pearl. And that was perfectly right. Those pearls brought their own problems to the leading families. You couldn't really talk about rulers of the whole country at that time, more leading sheikhs of particular tribes. There were arguments over the division of money, division of the wealth from the pearls. And of course, as families got bigger, those arguments got more difficult. And with that came also struggles over succession, who was going to succeed as leader of the tribe, etc. So internally, there were issues. And looking externally, a lot of the foreign engagements that Qatar went through were determined by their interest in pearls. One of the key issues of Qatari history is the story of Zubara, which is on the northwestern coast. And it's here, really, that the enmity, animosity, perhaps, between the Al-Khalifa, who ruled Bahrain, and the Al-Thani, who currently rule Qatar, arose. It arose, really, before the Al-Thani came to prominence. The Al-Khalifa were prominent in Zubara and then conquered Bahrain and moved there in the 19th century. Then, as a result of that, they still held a claim to Zubara, which, as time went on and the Al-Thanis emerged, the Al-Thanis contested that claim. And it was a bone of contention between them, and it could be argued is still a bone of contention between them today. Looking to the other side of Qatar, towards Abu Dhabi, which is, of course, part of the UAE, there was competition over pearls and territory. And a lot of the conflicts with Abu Dhabi around about the 1880s can be explained by their rivalry over pearls and an interest and ambition from both leading sheikhs to take possession of the pearling grounds that stretched really from Gata down to Ras El Khaimah. And then, of course, there's the old question of Saudi Arabia and Gata's relations with Saudi Arabia, which wasn't necessarily determined by pearls, but was more determined by dynastic and tribal considerations. And the fact that Saudi Arabia, obviously at that time known as Nejd, was a central Arabian sheikhdom, emirate, and had ambitions towards Gata. And from there, we see that, again, there were rivalries and struggles that grew up between Gata and Saudi Arabia over territory.
Slavery played a role in all of this, and obviously Qatar, like Saudi Arabia, was one of the last to abolish the vestige of slavery. Yet, so almost symbiotic, if you wish, of the differences between Qatar and other Gulf states, Qatar today is the only Gulf state with a museum dedicated to the history of slavery in the region.
It is, and I visited the museum when I was there in 2018. In a way, it's surprising because I think there is still a taboo about slavery in the Gulf, and they don't like talking about it very much in the past. But it is obviously a fact of history. And so Gata has created this museum to slavery, the Bin Jelmud House, which in its way is very informative and educational, and also covers modern slavery, which you can see might be a problem as far as the Qataris are concerned with the current kafala system. You could say this is also
the kafala system being the sponsorship of employees by employers, which really in some ways made the employee dependent on the employer.
Correct. That's right. So as far as the slavery museum goes, it's a useful and interesting addition to the already number of museums in Doha. In that sense, it's very helpful. But looking towards the bigger picture, you can also see that this is part of Gata's power drive, if you like, to influence and impress the outside world, and also to accept part of its history.
It's also in the sense, I mean, Qatar, and that's part of, in a sense, one of the dichotomies of Qatar. It differed with other Gulf states in its support for the popular Arab revolts in 2011. It publicly promotes concepts of human rights, of democracy, of freedom of the press, even if those are not all really implemented at home. But it seemed to me that the opening of the Museum of Slavery in or the History of Slavery in Qatar was part of that dichotomy. With other words, wanting to be at the cutting edge and being seen as progressive, and in some ways maybe the museum is one of the few instances where they walk the talk. With other words, they've actually done something at home.
Yes, I think that's right. That there is this dichotomy, and you see it in freedom of the press, Al Jazeera reporting of events abroad, and yet at home there's this concept of self-censorship, which is, you know, censorship in everything. So there is that dichotomy. Again, human rights, even support for democracy, although there has been some support for democracy from the Amir Hamad when he was ruling, that's been limited and not as extensive as one might hope it would be. I mean, there is an argument to say that perhaps democracy isn't the way forward for these countries at the present time. But that's another debate to be had. The fact is that there is this dichotomy between what's happening inside Gata and what's happening on the outside, and particularly the way it has pursued certain objectives through its foreign policy.
Indeed. We perceive Gulf states in general, certainly the smaller Gulf states, as recently established entities with little history. In the case of Gata, your book argues very convincingly the opposite and suggests Gata's history explains what it represents today and many of the issues that have garnered it controversy and headlines, including the winning of the 2022 World Cup hosting rights and the now more than three-year-old Saudi United Arab Emirates-led diplomatic and economic boycott. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah, so Gata's history, you can trace it back to the 18th century when tribes were coming out of Central Arabia and settling along the Qatari coast. And as I mentioned before, the Al Khalifa, who eventually went to Bahrain, in fact, it was 1783 that they conquered Bahrain. The Al Khalifa settled in Zubarah. The Al Thani didn't emerge really till about the 1850s when the leader of the family, Muhammad Al Thani, moved to Doha from Furat. Again, attracted by pearls and starting, or in fact continuing, a family business in the pearl trade. So you've got that background of dynastic conflicts going back way back into the past. With Abu Dhabi, you've got a conflict over Khor Al Udeid, which today, of course, is where the American airbase is situated. But in those days was an inlet which was frequented mainly by pirates hiding from the British, and the British boats couldn't get into the inlet, and therefore the pirates were safe there. But that became a spot where both Abu Dhabi and the Qataris under Sheikh Jassim, that's where they a place that they vied over. You then get the foreign interventions, and in those events you can almost see a similarity with the current day in the way that Qatar has sought the support of larger foreign countries. For example, I'm thinking of Turkey and the way that that's developed in modern times. In the past, of course, the Ottomans arrived in Doha in 1871. The flags were first flown then, and they continued until 1916, to the middle of the First World War. And the garrison there, although established and also confirmed an Ottoman presence, was more of a token gesture more than anything else. It had very little influence over the interior, and in fact, the Ottoman troops were prohibited from marching more than 4 hours inland, which rather limited them anyway. So they had a rather patchy history staying in Doha for the time that they did. In fact, they were defeated in 1893 by an army led by the Qatari Sheikh Jassim, the famous Battle of Wajba. And then, of course, the British come along. They'd always been there. The British saw the Ottomans, first of all, perhaps, as a helpful influence in the Gulf in suppressing piracy, which, of course, the British were keen to put down. But then over time came to see the Ottomans more as a threat to their interests in the Gulf, which eventually that question was resolved in 1913, when the Ottomans made a treaty with the British and eventually retired from the fort at Doha. So you've got those foreign interventions, which obviously had an impact. And then, of course, the British then take over, in effect, as the prominent foreign power. leading up to the Treaty of Protection in 1935, which was all around the question of oil. And by now, the British had realised they had a more pressing interest in Gatta, whereas before it was more of a marginal interest. But now they had a pressing interest in Gatta with the promise of oil being discovered, which, of course, it was at Dukan in 1940. So you've got that theme, which also reflects the traditional Arab strategy of seeking the support of a more powerful neighbour. And you can see how that fits well with the current arrangements. There's also another theme that works its way through is the question of succession. Again, I've referred to that briefly, but it really became a big problem from 1949 onwards, when it seemed to dominate the affairs of the ruling family, and the politics, such as they were, which existed within the ruling family, were overtaken, really, by the question of succession. There was Ali, who took over in 1949, but of course the favourite for succession had been the Sheikh's other son, Hamad, but unfortunately he died in 1948. Ali then indicated he wanted his son Ahmad to succeed him, which he did in 1960. But there was also in the background Khalifa, who was the son of Hamad. He was always vying for influence and felt also that, in fact, the throne was rightfully his. So you had that going on as well. And eventually, Khalifa overthrew Ahmad in 1972. Of course, all this really comes to a head in 1995, when Hamad mounted his coup and removed Khalifa. And although that then put an end to the family struggle over succession, and Hamad made it clear that he wanted Tamim in the 2000s to succeed him, which he, of course, he did in 2013. That seems to have paid to the old problem of succession the wranglings within the larger Al Thani family group.
You describe how Ghatas' ruling family, the Al Thanis, hail from an area north of Riyadh in what is today Saudi Arabia. And another tantalizing fact that you note in the book is that the Al Thanis left Saudi Arabia before Wahhabism, the austere Saudi interpretation of Islam, emerged in what is now the kingdom. Do those facts help explain Ghatas' complex relationship with the kingdom?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think that's an important part of it. I mean, they share a common heritage in that sense. And there were times when Gatta had moved quite close to the Wahhabi interpretation of Islam, certainly during the time of Sheikh Jashim in the late 19th century. Jashim used to affect Neji clothes and also followed the Wahhabi way. So in that sense, Gatta has in the past swayed from that version to the more modern version, which is perhaps more liberal and forward-looking. Although it has to be said, of course, that Saudi Arabia has been relaxing its austereness in more recent times. And so, you know, perhaps there's a greater coming together. But certainly in the last couple of decades, this has been a matter of friction between the two countries, the differing views of Islam and the way that it's interpreted in both countries.
Coming back to the Ottomans for a second, Al Thani's support for the Ottomans was grounded in seeing them sort of as the least bad of the options, which included the Wahhabis, as well as the dominant Al Khalifa family in Bahrain and the British. Why did they see the Ottomans that way, and why did the Qataris ultimately become disillusioned with the Ottomans?
Well, the Qataris were being harassed by the Saudis at the time, because there was an ongoing battle between the two contenders for the Saudi throne, and Saud bin Faisal was regularly raiding Gatta and cutting off the water to Doha and taking munitions from the people. So they needed protection. Clearly, it wasn't so long ago that the Al Khalifa had ruled the whole peninsula as such. And so you can see certainly from the sheikhs in Doha and Wakra and around that area, the pearling sheikhs, if you like, or the, I think I call it in the book, the Doha Confederation. Clearly, having the inviting the Al Khalifa back in wasn't an acceptable idea. The British, I think, you know, there was talk perhaps of the British being the prominent power, but it was hoped, I think, certainly by Sheikh Jassim, that the Ottomans wouldn't really impose a great authority on the country and he would be free to basically carry on his own ways. His father, Mohammed, the man that William Palgrave had seen in 1863, he did prefer to have dialogue with the British rather than the Ottomans. But of course, Jassim succeeded in 1878. And from there, he sort of conducted this two-way policy with the Ottomans. He would cooperate with them to a certain extent when it suited his own objectives. For example, Jassim had designs on Bahrain, and also the Ottomans did. They wanted to prise Bahrain away from the British, who were the protective power there. And so we have an incident in Zubara in 1895 when Jassim has actually collected a fleet together under the Ottoman flag and is prepared to invade Bahrain, at which point the British intervened and sank some of his fleet and captured the other vessels. So there was, you know, this aspect with Jassim of really trying to play both sides and using the Ottomans where the Ottomans were useful, i.e. for protection against outsiders, but also trying to exploit them to his own ends. In the end, Jassim got fed up with the Ottomans because they didn't really provide any stability. They were unable to assist him in his military ventures. They didn't suppress piracy, and they became irksome. Some, according to who was the Ottoman representative of the times, but some could be very intrusive and demand to be consulted on everything. And again, I think Jassim found that quite irritating. As time went on, Jassim took a back seat and his brother Ahmed effectively ruled from Doha. And he was more interested in having a treaty with the British. The British were in two minds about that, really reflecting a split between the India Office, which wanted to resist the Ottoman influence in Gata, and the Foreign Office, which really looked at the larger picture, and particularly in Europe, and perhaps making deals with the Ottomans, which could then be used in the Gulf, perhaps as leverage or, you know, in exchange for allowing the Ottomans to have some leeway in the Gulf. So there were all those things going on. And finally, I don't think it was any great loss to the Qataris, and they didn't feel that way, that the Ottomans departed during the First World War.
You've mentioned Jassim al-Thani a number of times. He's a legendary figure in Qatar mythology and seen as the founder of the nation. He also represented the long-gone history of close ties to the Al Saud family in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi form of Islam, Wahhabism. Tell us more about Jassim.
Well, Jassim was a remarkable character in many ways. He was born in Furarat, we think, in the 1820s and grew up with his family there. When his father Mohammed moved to Doha, he made the move with him, and Palgrave met him when he visited Mohammed in 1863 and describes this figure dressed in Neji clothing in the desert. Jassim had very clear idea of what he wanted and did take issue with his father over a number of matters. But overall, that didn't seem to completely ruin his relationship with his father, and he seems to have been on generally reasonable terms with his father until his father died in 1878. You can see then Jassim trying to assert himself over several areas. There's Zubara and the whole question of the Al-Khalifa in Bahrain, Jassim collecting his men and his ships to try and invade Bahrain, conflict with Abu Dhabi. And it's really in the conflict with Abu Dhabi we see another side perhaps of Jassim, because in 1887 his favourite son Ali was killed by an Abu Dhabi raiding party, which had quite a profound effect on Jassim, to the extent that he vowed revenge. And there is this description in the book of a massacre in the Liwa Oasis, which belonged to Abu Dhabi, that Yassin's men carried out. So in that respect, you know, we see perhaps a more ruthless side of Jassim. Of course, he won this famous victory at Wahba, and a lot of that was obviously due to his own prominence and desire to, you know, shake off the Ottoman yoke, if you like. Also owed part of his success to the fact that he had Martini Henry rifles. And here we have a whole new dimension opening up, because it was through his Kuwaiti contact, Yusuf al-Ibrahim, that he was able to secure these rifles, which were being smuggled up and down the Gulf and overland. The British were trying to put a stop to it, but inevitably the rifles got through. And they were perfect for desert warriors, if you like, who could move quickly, shoot from the hip on their horses, and then disappear into the desert again. So that was a huge advantage to him. The Kuwaiti dimension adds a regional side to Yassim's story, because Jassim, through his friendship with Yusuf al-Ibrahim, became quite heavily involved in Kuwaiti politics, particularly when Mubarak took the throne after murdering his two brothers, and al-Ibrahim took the side of the murdered brothers' families. So there was immediately there a divide in the ruling family of Kuwait. And of course, because of what Yusuf al-Ibrahim had done for Jassim and all the help he'd provided and their friendship, he took al-Ibrahim's side. And there was the start of an army marching towards Kuwait from Gata. It was proposed to link up with the al-Rashid, a tribe from northern Arabia, and together they were going to march on Kuwait and intended to defeat Mubarak, Sheikh Mubarak. Unfortunately, Jassim got to the boundary, such as it was, let's say the base of the Ghatta Peninsula, and he heard news that the Sheikh of the Rashid had in fact passed away, natural causes. And so his men wouldn't be coming, and at that point, Jassim called it off. You know, it would have been a remarkable thing had he marched up to Kuwait and taken part in the, you know, battle against Mubarak. Of course, it didn't happen. So there's that aspect of Jassim, which again provides a fascinating part of Ghatta's history, which you don't often read about. Then in the early 20th century, Jassim retires to the desert. And I have to say, retiring to the desert was one of his tactics when he got fed up with the Ottomans. He would just disappear into the desert for months on end, leaving the Ottomans to sort of carry the can, if you like. But eventually, Jassim took on a more permanent retirement in the desert. and his brother Ahmed, as I've said before, ruled from Doha. Unfortunately, Ahmed was assassinated, I think it was in 1905, and Yassin effectively was called back into the frame and had to then rule again until his son Abdullah could take over. That in itself caused dynastic problems. The sons of Ahmed felt that they should succeed. There was Ahmed's elder brother, Khalifa, who also felt that he should succeed. And of course, Abdullah, who eventually succeeded. Abdullah was more interested in pearls than, seemed to be more interested in pearls and fighting. But in fact, he proved to be a good desert leader. And took over from Yassin when Yassin passed away in 1913. So yes, he was a remarkable man and is held in great esteem in Ghatta even today. And you can see, again, it's a point I'm making in my book, that because I think you were alluding to it earlier, that a lot of these countries appear to have had little history. I don't agree with that. I think they've got a rich and varied history, which goes back a fair way. But in order to bolster the sense of nationhood, if you like, of course, these stories of the past, you know, Yassin, the great hero, the founder of the nation, all helps with that and to project a picture of a Ghatta with the past, because it's said that a nation without a history is no nation at all. So, you know, there is a history there, and Yassin perhaps symbolizes an important part of it, epitomizes an important part of it.
Much of the history of Ghatta in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th century that you describe is one of tribal intrigues and the playing of rivalries between external powers present in the region. How much of that do you see today in modern day Ghatta today?
I don't think you could say that the tribal intrigues are necessarily apparent. I mean, no doubt they go on, but they're not widely reported, certainly within the Al Thani family. I mean, you have to look at the events of the 1950s and 1960s to get a good account of what was going on between the various sections of the ruling family. There is, I suppose, an influence from outside, the strong tribal links between certain Saudi tribes and Ghatta, which have exerted a certain influence on Ghatta and events in Ghatta in the past and in the, you know, quite recent past as well, which has resulted a couple of times in expulsions of members of tribes with strong affinities with Saudi tribes. So is that going on as well? I think the great tragedy of the blockade is that there's a lot of connections between these countries, Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain. A lot of movement of people, not necessarily tribal related, but generally through families interlinked, which of course has all been stopped now and no longer happens. But as far as the old days of you know, tribal squabbling is concerned within Ghatta, again, we do get hints and occasionally a glimpse at that, but nothing like it used to be in the 50s and 60s.
Part of the change that seems to have happened is that that more recently, probably as Ghatta became much more wealthy with oil and gas, that the politics of Ghatta have changed. With other words, you no longer see in that, to that degree at least, the clamoring for a reduction of absolute power of the Al Thanis, demands for fairer distribution of oil revenues, and calls for political reform, part of which were obviously fueled by the popularity of Arab nationalism and Egypt's leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Yeah, I think that's right. of course, there's this theory of the social contract in which the ruler provides stability and the population receive generous benefits. And so in that sense, it's in the Qataris' interests to have a stable government rather than, you know, particularly after the Arab Spring, have threats to that stability by way of, you know, changing the government structure, moving closer more quickly towards democracy and the like. And, you know, it is said, as I mentioned, that it can be argued that, in fact, you know, this model of government perhaps suits that type of society the best, because there's still the tribal links within government and society to keep it all bound together. So, yes, the emphasis on political reform has definitely slowed down from periods in the past when it built up quite a head of steam. And, of course, now with the coronavirus and the impending World Cup, there are more pressing problems, perhaps also with the blockade of economic survival and also delivering the World Cup, if that is going to go ahead in 2022. Clearly, the whole country is geared up for that. And when I went there in 2018, it was quite amazing how much work was being done in building the stadiums. And, you know, everywhere you looked, there was a building site and workers trudging to and fro in buses to the building sites and the like. So, yeah, I think the foot has gone off the change pedal somewhat. Of course, the wealth from oil and gas, we used to think of oil as Qatar as an oil-rich country, and it was natural gas that really made the big change. Massive reserves of natural gas, which then brought into play another country in the Gulf, which was Iran. And potentially there is scope for conflict between Qatar and Iran. And Qatar, one of the reasons why Qatar has attracted the enmity of its neighbours is its relations with Iran. And it's, I suppose, its desire not to upset the apple cart with Iran, because, of course, Iran is more powerful, far more powerful than Qatar would ever be militarily. And also explains why Qatar has sought the protection of the United States by having a United States airbase in the country. Although, again, that could be seen as rather contradictory, bearing in mind the Iranians' view of the Americans. But so far, it seems to have worked.
And of course, Iran and Qatar share the world's largest gas field.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So they obviously have to work together to some degree and have some civility in relationships. One of the things that also sort of disappeared from the period where you had more political demands is labor unrest.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that's part of the wealth accumulated by the company, by the country trickling down. It's also a function of, and you mentioned this earlier, demography, with Qataris becoming a small minority in their own country. Mm. However, can you sort of relate that history of labor, if you wish, to the kafala system, and also the fact that, like we were talking in the case of the slavery museum in Doha, the fact that perhaps under pressure because of the World Cup hosting rights, Qatar really took a lead in addressing issues raised by trade unions, by human rights groups with regard to the kafala system.
Yeah. So really it was the coming of oil that first brought labor unrest to the oil fields, and also Colonel Nasser in Egypt, Gamal Nasser, and the Arab nationalism, which was sweeping the region at the time. So you have in the mid-1950s arrest and unrest in the oil fields, and you have demonstrations in the towns, and particularly Doha, which was suppressed with some difficulty for a time. But eventually those problems disappeared, again, with rising prosperity, rising affluence, workers, and also the coming of the kafala system, which meant that the work was done by foreign workers who obviously were in no position to argue in the same way that local tribespeople had been in the past. The kafala system in some ways has echoes of slavery in the sense that you have a society that's used to relying on workers from abroad, in the case of slaves, most of them coming from Africa, and moving towards the kafala system, which again has workers coming from abroad, although obviously the circumstances are quite different from the days of slavery. But you can see there that there's a society which has been used to relying on foreign workers over quite a long period of time. The Qataris, it is true to say that the Qataris have made progress with the kafala system, not necessarily to the extent that these foreign organisations would like completely. There's still concerns about domestic abuse of foreign workers, but certainly made efforts, particularly with the World Cup coming up, to reform the system, abolish the system of certificates whereby no objection certificates, whereby workers were required to prove that their employers did not object to them leaving the country before they could do so. So things like that are certainly a step in the right direction.
You describe in the book in great detail how oil has changed life in Qatar. Yet you also suggest that in some ways oil and modernity cemented the traditional tribal ways and their dynamic. Can you elaborate a bit about that?
Yes, clearly oil did change life. It wasn't a sudden change. I mean, in the early days, it happened over a period of time. Obviously, it was only more recent times and suddenly things took off and skyscrapers shot up, etc., and roads appeared from nowhere. But it did obviously change the society. Firstly, in the oil fields, the workers came across from Doha and then stayed for a week and then went back again to Doha. Their lives were quite hard and difficult and again may have contributed towards the industrial unrest of the mid-1950s. But as time went on, the oil revenues came in and grew and Qatar became more prosperous. You can see how the status quo was in fact preserved. Now, you think that was contradictory, that, you know, the arrival of all this money would somehow change society to the extent that, you know, the ruling structure would change as well. But of course, underneath it all is a tribal society, and that never changed. And at the top of the tribal structure is the sheikh. And again, that didn't change. And the sheikh, of course, had more money now to distribute. And when I talk about the sheikh, I'm really talking about the ruler. He had more money to distribute towards his family. And, you know, this then developed into a generous social security system and, you know, aspects like that, which, you know, made Qatar into the country it is today, and also explains, I think, why the political system is, you know, on the whole, unchanged since those, you know, tribal days, because essentially it is underneath it all a tribal structure, which is bolstered by the wealth that has come through oil and natural gas.
In many ways, the 1990 invasion, Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, was a watershed in terms of Qatari relations with Saudi Arabia, as well as the Gulf states' defense and foreign policy. Can you tell us why and how that manifested itself?
Well, I think it was a realization that Saudi Arabia effectively wasn't, you know, the savior that Qatar perhaps in the past has thought it might be, the great protector. And the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein's forces, I think, exposed that, and certainly in the Qataris' mind, made it clear that they might have to look elsewhere for their protector. And this is where the United States came into play. Of course, the United States were heavily involved in repulsing Saddam's forces from Kuwait. And as a result, the Qataris made an agreement with the US to build an airbase at Khor Al Udeid. And this, it wasn't a straightforward relationship between the Americans and the Qataris. I've already mentioned the Iranians, which clearly building an airbase in Qatar was at odds with. But there were ups and downs with the Americans as well. For example, when Qatar bought Stinger missiles, because the Americans had supplied Bahrain with Stinger missiles, Qatar appears to have obtained their own from somewhere, I think probably Iran or the black market. And of course, that upset the Americans. So, and in more modern times, American concerns about Qatar being close to terrorist organizations, radical organizations, unsettling forces in the Middle East, things like that, which has led to criticism in the United States of Qatar. But overall, and also, of course, there's Al Jazeera, and even culminating in the threat of the Americans to bomb Al Jazeera's office in Doha. So there have been these difficulties in the relationship. But overall, at the moment, certainly, Qatar and America are fairly strong allies together, despite everything that's happened.
Another thing that contributed to reshaping relations with Saudi Arabia was the gamble that the ruler, Emir Hamad, in the early 90s took in terms of investing in gas. And that's really what has also enabled Qatar to carve out a path of its own.
Yes. And the ultimate result of that was Qatar leaving OPEC because it no longer considered oil to be, you know, a major, it was an important part of its economy, but not the only bringer of wealth, if you like. And so Hamad's development of the North Field allowed that to happen. It's interesting because the North Field was discovered in the 1970s under the reign of Khalifa. And although Khalifa was obviously aware of it, he was reluctant to develop the field. I think in part because he was worried about the effect that that would have on Qatar's development. It would bring great development, bring in a lot of foreign workers, and again, skew the demographic balance. I'm sure that was going through his mind. And also the fact that he was a child of the pearling age, if you like. He was born in the 1920s, grew up when pearling was going into decline. So he remembered those times of hardship and the reliance on a single resource economy, which might sound attractive when it's going well. But of course, when the resource declines, then your whole economy is hit. So I think he, at the back of his mind as well, he had that, you know, to think about. So what happened in the end was Khalifa didn't develop it. And in fact, he became overcautious in his government of the country, which led to, of course, to Hamad's coup in 1995. There is, of course, in the longer term, natural gas is in plentiful supply. It's in demand. But of course, that demand will wane over time and the supplies eventually will run out. So, you know, Qatar clearly has to think about diversification. And there have been efforts to diversify through the Qatar Investment Authority, effectively its sovereign wealth fund, in order to provide a wider base for its economy rather than relying on a single commodity such as natural gas.
If I can throw one last speculative question at you, which may come a little bit out of left field, but given your intimate knowledge of Qatar, it strikes me that the resolution of the rift in the Gulf with Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, is going to have to involve a face-saving solution for all. What would be a face-saving solution for Qatar?
I think the World Cup provides a good opportunity. If you look at their economies, they're all suffering at the moment, and the World Cup provides an opportunity to for everyone to participate, certainly in the economic benefits of having the World Cup. And if they could unite under that, it would be, you know, certainly a good way to end past differences and be face-saving in the process. It would obviously entail a bit of give and take on both sides, but then such things usually do. There is, of course, underneath this all, very strong feelings. There's no indication that Bahrain really wants to compromise still, and I think history in part accounts for that. They have very strong feelings about Qatar, and even as recently as 2018, the King of Bahrain was claiming that all of Qatar was theirs. Whether that, you know, that's just talk and posturing, who knows, but certainly I think there's quite strong feelings on their side. And in the UAE under Mohammed bin Zayed, again, very strong feelings about what Qatar has done by associating itself with the Muslim Brotherhood. It may be that the initiative will come from Saudi Arabia and whether the Qataris accept that. But at the end of the day, the Qataris have survived. And, you know, they perhaps aren't as desperate to compromise as you might have thought. And, you know, who knows? But I think certainly with the World Cup on the horizon, I think that would provide a great opportunity to brush over past differences and, you know, basically share the World Cup, not the games necessarily, but the accommodation and stuff like that, and move on, you know, move on together. Because at the end of the day, they're very similar in their governments and tribal societies, and they really have a great affinity with each other despite these arguments. And of course there are enemies ranged against them who would quite happily see them be divided. So it is in their interest to come together, and, you know, I think overall everyone hopes that eventually they will.
Quentin, we could go on easily for another hour, but unfortunately we're ending or nearing the end of this interview. Before I let you go, what's your next project? Where do you go from here?
I'm taking a bit of a break from writing at the moment. I'm still writing articles, some of them on the history of oil, and I'll just see where it goes. I'm still interested in Gulf history, perhaps another history of one of the Gulf countries, perhaps even Saudi Arabia. But at the moment, I'm sort of sitting back and taking stock, if you like. I've written in the past 10 years up to, I think it's 9 books on the region. And, you know, that's quite a pace. So I'm quite happy to take a back seat for a time and let things settle. And perhaps, you know, as I say, write articles and see what comes up. But, you know, I've enjoyed it so far, but it seems the right time to take a break.
Quentin, those seem like good ideas. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care and all the best.
Thank you, James, for having me. Thank you.